Blog Talk Radio.
Wow. That's the first time I heard that one. Hey, everybody. This is Janine, and you're listening to Lunch with Loudon. Coffee Talk Radio shows are part of the Coffee Party Be the Media project. You can join our team at www.coffeepartyusa.com/volunteer. Let us know if you'd like to be a part of Be the Media. So after that wild and crazy opening, it's a surprise gift from my co-host, Debbie Lynn Molyneux, who won't be joining us today. Kind of if you weren't awake, I'm sure you are now. Today is a very special day. I'd like to bring on Eric Beiler, president of Coffee Party USA, and also one of the co-founders of the Story of America video documentary project. Eric, go ahead and open your mic, because I want people to know that what we're going to talk about today. It's a very special show for me.
Okay, well, thank you, Janine. We are in Belhaven, North Carolina, and as part of the Story of America project, we had the really good fortune of coming into contact with Bob Zellner. He's 75 years young as of a few days ago, and he is from Lower Alabama, L.A., as he likes to call it, and he is... He's the son and grandson of members of the Ku Klux Klan, but early in his life, he began to see that our country's destiny was to go in a different direction. And he became, as a young man, as a student, a courageous leader in the civil rights movement. He's the first white Southerner to lead the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Committee? He'll tell me in a second if I got it wrong. SNCC, which was really kind of the cutting edge of the civil rights movement in the South. And he also is part of the Moral Monday movement in North Carolina. The man does not stop. And that's how we came into contact with him. He was among the first 17 people arrested on April 29, 2013, in what became known as the Moral Monday movement. He has been keeping up with the actions of the NAACP in Belhaven, North Carolina, which is about 2 hours from where he lives in Wilson, North Carolina. And just yesterday, Bob was curious enough to accompany Annabelle Park and me to Belhaven, North Carolina. So today we're going to talk to him about some of the old-time stuff and some of the new-time stuff that he is currently involved in, and maybe a little bit about his impressions of Belhaven. So, with that, let me bring on Bob Zellner. Thanks for joining us, Bob.
Hello, Eric. How are you?
I'm doing great. Bob is actually about 14 feet away from me. But the hello sounded as if he was far away. Anyway, so Bob, let me just start by asking you, what are your impressions of Belhaven so far?
What are my impressions of what now?
Of Belhaven.
Oh, Belhaven is a beautiful place. It's a gorgeous place on the Pimlico River and in the tidewater of eastern North Carolina, inside the Outer Banks. And it's beautiful in two ways. Number one, it's a gorgeous old southern town. And number two, the struggle here has put together some of the best people in the white community and the African-American community, and they've made a very strong unity and developed a lot of power for the 99%, and it's going to be a huge lesson to our country. It's a very important part of the Moral Monday efforts in North Carolina, which is becoming a beacon for the whole United States. So when you're in Belhaven, the little town of Belhaven, you feel like you're in the epicenter of what's happening now.
And just to fill in our listeners who may not have seen some of the Story of America videos, but Belhaven, North Carolina is on the coast. It is, they have a 60-year-old hospital that was 2 years ago purchased by a hospital corporation that has bought up most of the hospitals in this region of the state. Although it is actually against the law to buy a hospital for the purpose of closing it, the corporation called Vidant was able to put itself in a position where they were going to be able to do that, and thus essentially streamline the revenue flow for the region into other hospitals, which is good for the profit line, but it's bad for people who live in this area and relied on having a hospital that was close enough for them to get to in an emergency. So the NAACP of North Carolina stepped in and partnered with the local Republican mayor, Adam O'Neill, to really raise a lot of heck in this area, making it really painful for the hospital to go forward with this closing, which was supposed to be on April 1st. They filed a complaint with the United States Department of Justice, and the Justice Department came in and said, we need to mediate a settlement. The settlement is that the hospital is going to remain open. It's a huge victory for the people of this region who were in danger of not having health care, not having emergency services within, for some people, 80, 90, 100 miles. But as Bob said, it also represents, in some ways, I guess you could say it's a dream come true for you, Bob, because since your first days in the movement, your job was trying to unite people across political and racial division, right?
Yes, Eric. My first job in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, was to be a campus traveler across the South. I was the first white Southerner to be a field secretary for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And my job was to go to white campuses, but also black campuses as well, and talk about the civil rights movement. The Lynch County sit-ins had started here in North Carolina February 1st, 1960, had swept the South, and had re-energized the civil rights movement that had been kicked forward by Mrs. Rosa Parks and Dr. Martin Luther King and Montgomery. That's where I first got involved when I was a student at Huntington College in Montgomery. And Dr. King and Mrs. Parks were good enough to mentor me and some other young people from my all-white campus at Huntington College. And so I had gone on the SNCC staff in the fall of 1961, the beginning of the SNCC staff, really. And my first job was to begin to relate to the white South. And really for over 50 years now, I've worked in this endeavor with Dr. King and Ms. Rosa Parks, and now with Reverend Dr. William Barber of the NAACP in North Carolina. And he's linking up with incredibly wonderful young leaders like Adam O'Neill here in Belhaven, and all the black mentors that he has, like Mr. Butch Bonner and others. And it's just an incredible fruition of the kind of work that we've done for so long to get fusion politics back into the South and make a basic change in the politics of the South so that we can pay attention to the general welfare, not channel all the money and all the power in very few pockets.
Mm-hmm. You know, the Coffee Party's, I guess you could say its impetus came from the Citizens United decision 4 years ago, January 21st was the decision. January 26th was the beginning of the Coffee Party Facebook page. Annabelle Park, who's here with us in Belhaven, posted a complaint about not only that, but also the generation of a, I guess you could call it a faux populist movement to decry the outcome of the 2008 election, and to basically use very, very, very powerful media tools to create this sort of funhouse mirror of our society and create the illusion that our country had rejected the outcome of its own election in 2008. But I wanted to ask you, because something that really kind of perked my interest when you told us yesterday about the only time as a nonviolent organizer that you had to pull out a gun. And you said something at the end of that story that really sort of united a couple of different storylines for me, and that was that you were actually in more danger trying to organize unions than you were trying to fight for voting rights and civil rights. So I was wondering if you could just tell that story and also tell me why you think there's this weird sort of alignment between organizations like the Ku Klux Klan, with which you battled so, you know, bravely over these decades, and the kinds of interests that would want to prevent there from being unions?
Yes. Well, that really came to be very clear to me at the end of my work with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, in 1967 and 68. We had conceived of a project we call GROW, Grassroots Organizing Work, which we also called Get Rid of Wallace. And that was a project that would take a lot of the white young people that had worked in the civil rights movement and basically in the black community in the Deep South, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, and redirect our efforts to working with poor and working class white Southerners to bring them into coalition and joint work with the power that had been developed in the black community. That was our job in the late 60s. As SNCC became an all-black organization, it was time for us to do that. So one of the ways that we reached white working-class Southerners and poor working-class Southerners was to do union organizing. We had started working in the Delta, Mississippi, with Ms. Fannie Lou Hamer. We were working in conjunction with Dr. King and the Poor People's Campaign that was focusing on Memphis, Tennessee, and Washington, D.C. And part of the job that we had undertaken was to go to Klan-infested places where the Klan had always been anti-black and also anti-union, and to begin to try to organize in the white community. And we discovered then that union organizing, as we had studied union history and so forth, had a very violent history. Both sides generally in union struggles in the coal mines and in the western mines, in the south, so forth, were usually armed. So we did take the precaution, even though many of us had been stalwarts in the nonviolent direct action movement, and we did arm ourselves not to be aggressive use of violence, but simple self-protection or self-defense. And I was telling a story to the mayor and some of the people here in Belhaven that one of the times that we were attacked on the road between Laurel, Mississippi and New Orleans, our base of operations out of New Orleans, and we worked in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia. And on the roads, sometimes we would be ambushed by the Klan people. And one time there was an attempt to force me off the road in Mississippi, and I happened to have my old Webley 45 revolver handy. And the person in the pickup truck that was cursing me and trying to keep my attention off of the bridge that was coming up, which I clearly understood he was going to try to force me into the bridge abutment or over the edge into the river, I just simply raised my revolver up. And he, in avoiding the pointed revolver, he almost turned his truck over and fled back the other way after his truck did a 180 in the middle of the road. And I heard later on from some of the Klan people in that same, that was around Poplarville, Mississippi, and I heard later on that the Klan had bitterly complained that we were supposed to be nonviolent and that I had pulled a gun on the guy that was trying to run me off the road. So, you know, there were always humorous incidents and very serious incidents also.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, so, I mean, this, you know, you pull out your gun for the first time after all of these years and decades. You were arrested 17 times back in the day and 18th time last year with the Moral Monday movement. You were telling us today, telling the mayor and his mom and Annabelle and I at lunch that, you know, you were tortured in jail in Louisiana. The famous story that's available on the Time Magazine interview about the time that you were mobbed by KKK members and nearly lost your life, also nearly lost an eye in that brawl. And then after all of that, it was a huge surprise to me, and I'm sorry that I didn't know this, that also organizing against the existence of unions. And I wonder if you could explain why that is. I mean, what's the connection, basically, between being against civil rights and voting rights and basic human rights for African Americans, being against Jews and other minorities? What's the connection between that and being against unions?
Well, it's a very direct connection, and it goes back in history. Dr. King made it clear, even in his last speech in Memphis, Tennessee, when he was working with the garbage workers, trying to get a union for garbage workers in Memphis, Tennessee. And he clearly pointed out in his political development and in his speech to the people that the labor movement was synonymous with the civil rights movement, that all of the things that the black community and the poor community and the immigrant community needed, all of the things that it needed, good education, good wages, secure jobs, safe working conditions, good schools, good hospital care, good health care, they were all exactly the same issues that organized labor had always worked for and around. So he said there's no difference in the labor movement and the civil rights movement. Civil rights movement is the labor movement. The labor movement is the civil rights movement. Dr. Barber and the Moral Monday movement and the NAACP in North Carolina is very clear on that as well, that the North Carolina Constitution, which was passed during Reconstruction, in fusion politics of poor white and working class white Southerners and ex-slaves, produced one of the best state constitutions there is, and it guarantees the enjoyment of the fruit of one's labor. So that when we have an extreme right wing take over in North Carolina, not Republican, not Democrat, but extreme right wing, they move as strong against civil rights as they move against the labor movement. So the labor movement and the civil rights movement has always been synonymous. The Klan plays a role in that because the Klan has always been made up predominantly of poor and working-class white Southerners or working-class white Americans in other parts of the country. And what they have been done, they've been bamboozled by the 1% into working against their own economic interests in the name of racial hatred. So in the same sense that the Ku Klux Klan opposed the civil rights movement on the behalf of the planters and the wealthy and the 1% during the civil rights movement, they still today, then and today, oppose the labor movement. For exactly the same reasons. They are the tool of the super right wing. The right wing looks down on the Klan and the skinheads and the Nazis, but they use them as their weapons. They use them as their weapons against civil rights workers, against labor union workers. And in a situation like saving the hospital in North Carolina, in Belhaven, Pungo Hospital, the right wing will extremely, they will support the closing of the hospital, not to keep the hospital open for poor people. So they always go against their own interests in favor of the people who already have more wealth and power than they know what to do with. So that's why today the Poverty Law Center is keeping an eye on paramilitary groups. They're growing in strength, and the clash is becoming more and more polarized. And to the extent that the Klan and the Nazis and the skinheads support the position of the 1% against the 99%, they are not of the people. They are opposed to the people. They always have been. Their roots go right back to the patty rollers, the poor whites in the South who were commissioned by the plantation owners, the rich people, to control the slaves. So they're still in that position. You may be poor yourself. You may be deprived of all the things that you need, but at least you're better than the black man. So that's been the dynamic all along. But what's happening at the grassroots now in North Carolina is that this extreme right has hurt the working class, poor and white working class Southerners as much as anybody else, and they are beginning to see that their economic interest lies in getting together with all of the people who are similarly situated, including blacks, LGBTs, immigrants, Latinos, etc. So there's a new fusion movement politics sweeping the country, and it's being led right here in North Carolina.
Well, I've seen it. I've definitely seen it. It's a fascinating thing, and, you know, I'm going to allow Janine to ask a question here, but I just wanted to share one little detail first, and that was that on the Facebook page that was designed to try to save this hospital, I think it's facebook.com/savepungo, there was a comment after the NAACP filed the complaint, and it was a person who had been active on the page trying to save the hospital, but when the complaint was announced in the news, the person basically said, well, I wanted the hospital to be saved, but if we have to work with the NAACP and claim this to be a race issue, then I'd just rather have it closed. Bob, I'll give you a chance to respond to that, but let me see if Janine has a question. Janine?
Hey, thanks very much, and hi, Bob. You and I spoke several months back, and it was a joy to interview you. You know, Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement are probably the single most influential thing in my life. And I like to think that I live my life today in honor of that movement, in honor of that man. And still, many people my age who were alive and awake and activists at whatever level we could be were asking, why are we here again? And I kind of hear the answer in the things that you've been discussing up to this point, the whole notion of it's better to be a poor white person than it is a rich, you know, than a black person. Or, I mean, there's a lot of things that you've said, but seriously, there are times I can hardly handle, you know, what I read from my communications with the Southern Poverty Law Center, or just looking at politics today. Why are we here again?
Why or what? Say again, please.
Well, why are we here again? Why are we looking at voting again? Why are we why has it become so fashionable and trendy to go right back to, as you just said, the days of George Wallace, for example? How is this possible? Because what shocks me is how willing people are to go back 40 years or 50 years in time as though it never happened. And I don't know what phenomena that is. Do you have any insight there?
Well, the question is, why are we here again? And why we have a song in the Civil Rights Movement saying that freedom is a constant struggle. Because even Chris Matthews of MSNBC said that all of American history is a civil war, sometimes fought with armies and bullets and weapons, and sometimes fought in courtrooms and in the streets. But it's always been a struggle in the United States between people who want to expand freedoms and broaden freedoms and deepen freedoms for people, and those people who want to restrict them and to make them more narrow and benefit only a smaller group of people. So that struggle has been constant in American history and will continue to be constant. Now, the question is not why are we doing this again, but why can't we succeed in getting over this certain hump? At the height of the civil rights movement, Dr. King and Ella Baker and other great leaders of the movement realized that during the civil rights movement, there was a liberal consensus across our country to do away with the last vestiges of de jure segregation, which only existed in the South. That's where segregation still reigned. We were in a ideological battle with communism, and the communist states were known as the slave states, godless communism, and the United States was known as the bastion of freedom for individuals. So the country said, how can we hold ourselves up as a bastion of freedom when young people can be burned on a bus, when they can set a bus on fire in Alabama, hold the door shut and try to kill those young people because they tried to do what? Ride together on a bus? How can we call ourselves the bastion of freedom if black people going to register to vote, the most elemental of democratic rights in Mississippi, risk death because they go and ask to register and vote? So there was a liberal consensus in the civil rights movement to go right through 64 Public Accommodations Act and the 65 Voting Rights Act. And everybody agreed, even Everett Dirksen and the Lincoln Republicans that worked together with Johnson and Kennedy's and so forth to get this job done. They knew that they had to do away with that. So that we got through that. But Dr. King and Ella Baker said, there is no American consensus now to go into a full-blown social and economic revolution in this country. They insisted on keeping rapacious capitalism that benefited fewer and fewer people with greater and greater wealth. So over the last 25 or 30 years, the gains of the civil rights movement has steadily been pushed back. In the civil rights movement, we said the rights of women would never be challenged again. They're challenging the rights of women every day in these right-wing legislatures. So all of these things are taking place again, and it really means that we have to have a more thoroughgoing social and economic revolution in this country. And there's not a liberal consensus that goes with that. That is a struggle that is an economic struggle, and it's the ones who have little against the tiny, tiny majority that are rich beyond all measure. No group of people in the history of human beings have been as rich as the American ruling class and the capitalist class. 85 individuals own 40% of America's, the world's wealth. So it's not just a revolutionary situation here in this country. It's a revolutionary situation worldwide. And this is just the beginning of a revolution against the counter-revolution that was made against the civil rights movement.
Well, that rings true. It rings true, especially given that Charles Koch just had his op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. He basically redefined freedom to be economic anarchy. Economic anarchy. That's what he called freedom. And he made it all warm and fuzzy by using words like respect and dignity, but it's not what he spoke to at all. And so anyway, I hear you, and I'm with you.
Okay. Well, we've got a lot of work to do, but, you know, there's a tremendous grassroots movement in here in North Carolina. We're going to have 50 to 60 full-time interns doing moral Freedom Summer. It's breaking out in other states. There are 15 or 20 states now that are going to have Moral Monday movements following what's happening here in North Carolina. There's a huge movement underway. And the national news is so good that you're doing this radio program informing people, because the national news is putting a bushel. They're putting a cover on Reverend Barber and what's happening here in North Carolina. They still want to keep that from happening. Even the civil rights establishment is cooperating with the ruling class to keep down support for grassroots organizing, but it's coming back. It's going to make another real forward advance in democracy in the world and in the United States.
Let me give out the number. If anybody would like to call and ask Bob a question, we're talking to Bob Zellner, the legendary civil rights leader. 646-929-2495 is the number, 646-929-2495. We have Jack calling in from Kansas with a question. Jack, hello there. How are you today?
Okay, this is me. Okay, Jack Golding, you hear me?
Hey, that's Jack from Kansas. How are you?
Kansas, yeah. Okay, now, you know what's happening in Kansas is terrible. And then even for Kansas, this guy is schmuck by the name of, Bryson? Forget his
your
name.
Governor?
No, I'm not talking about the governor. I'm talking about this guy with a Ku Klux Klanner.
The one that shot the people at the synagogue.
Yeah, three people. Okay.
Oh, yeah, the Klansman.
Two were shot in the synagogue, and one were killed in the synagogue grounds, and the third one was killed in the Jewish nursing home grounds. And that's what I was told, and it's coming back. I know that. Hate crimes have increased from double, I think, and I think since 2001 or 2002 to 2012, up now over 1,200 or something like that, hate crimes last year.
What went through your mind when you heard about that this person was an old Ku Klux Klan leader and he killed three people in Kansas?
Yeah, well, first of all, this individual has been on the radar of law enforcement for a long time. He was involved in shooting people here in North Carolina back in Greensboro when they attacked a communist march and he shot five people and killed some people in Greensboro. So this man has been involved over and over again in violent acts. He's known as a violent person. He's been followed. He was organizing paramilitaries that pulled together the Ku Klux Klan, the skinheads, and other neo-Nazi groups. He's an ex-veteran, not to smear all the Vietnam veterans and so forth, but there was a report that was developed by the United States government on watching ultra-right-wing paramilitary groups that were recruiting veterans, returned veterans, for these kinds of assaults and violence. This man has been followed and has been sued by the Poverty Law Center. Judgment after judgment has been reached against him. He should never have been allowed to be armed. He should never have been allowed to be free to go and kill these people. And it was not the act of a lone mad gunman that most of the time we say, oh, it was just somebody that went crazy. No, he's an organized member of the organized right wing that wants to take over for fascism in this country. And he's been coddled by law enforcement. And because there was so much pushback from the Tea Party and Fox News and the right-wing extremists in this country, that report was even withdrawn. It was repudiated by the United States government on this man and this paramilitary movement. So this is a failure of taking seriously this right-wing development. What they want to do is organize more and more of these right-wing militias, and with leadership like the Koch brothers and this ultra-right takeover in North Carolina, they want to use that in the same way they've used the Ku Klux Klan and the Patty Rollers all along. They want to use disadvantaged, shell-shocked, post-traumatic stress victims and so forth for their own violent means, and it's all to intimidate movement people. Shoot up synagogues, shoot the Jews, shoot the civil rights workers, and if there's not a correct response, there's going to be more and more of that, and there's a real danger to leaders in the civil rights movement now from this paramilitary buildup that has not been taken seriously by the authorities.
Bob, I want to circle back to this revelation for me about the Ku Klux Klan being used to organize against unions.
Yeah.
And see if you could talk about this historical, I guess you could call it symbiosis, between the plantation owner and the paddy roller, or between the Democratic Party political bosses and the basically the descendants of those planters, the oligarchy of the South, and the Ku Klux Klan. And now today, you know, are we being a little unfair? There are people who are basically, they have a favorite cable news station, but they're not, most of them aren't violent. They're very suggestible, and they'll believe things that aren't true, but that's not necessarily an evil thing. And you spent a lot of your career going out and talking to people who were in the grips of stuff that was, you know, basically racist mythology, and bringing them back and working with them and forming coalitions with these people. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of that, your intersection with that history, your intervention in that history, and tell us whether you see if there's hope today in maybe extending a hand to some of these folks who are essentially, I guess what you're saying is they're being manipulated by the ruling class.
Yes, and in fact, we've had experiences as far back as the Grove Project 50 years ago in the Deep South, where we had woodcutters and people who worked in poultry processing plants, catfish processing plants, black and white in Mississippi, getting together and organizing cooperatives. And we would go to Washington, and we would meet in Washington with the people from the Deep South, black and white working people. And we'd meet with Ted Kennedy, and he would be very supportive. Then we would go over to Eastland, the senator from Mississippi, and he'd say, "Oh, you're just a bunch of communists." And they had always counted on the Ku Klux Klan to be a reliable anti-union force. But when we were able to go into the communities and say, if you want a strong union, you want to get your union back in Laurel, Mississippi, and get your good contract back and your good wages, then you're going to have to work together black and white. And those same Klan people who had been anti-union, even members of the union, they were members of the union, but they were also in the Klan, which was basically anti-union. Once they switched over, they became really reliable allies in the civil rights movement and good union people. So it's possible to do that. And what's happening is that very few of the Klan members and the skinheads and the Nazis, very few of them are one percenters. They're 99%, and usually they're poor and working class, with not very much going for them. So they have a whole lot more in common with black people and people who need strong unions and strong community organizations like the one here in Belhaven, North Carolina, than they do with the one percenters who they serve. So that's what we have to do. We have to organize at the grassroots. We have to spend time, and we have to understand. When we began to work in Mississippi, we worked with Klan people. And we said, we don't care what your ideas are, what your feelings are, but as far as your behavior has to change if you're going to have the kind of unity that will give you the power to get the things you need. So that's the way to organize against the Klan and organize people away from the Klan and for union organizing. It's totally to the benefit of poor and working class people to have strong unions, but the right wing wants to abolish all unions. In North Carolina, they want to outlaw collective bargaining for public employees, for instance.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I mean, you know that Annabelle and I do a lot of that kind of outreach, and we talk to conservatives. We talk to a lot of the lawmakers that the Moral Monday movement is opposing in the North Carolina legislature. We talk to a lot of conservative activists, people who are really enthusiastic about the voting restrictions that were implemented last year, and also very much anti-union. And these people I would never have thought to really associate with anything like the Ku Klux Klan, but there is something interesting there in this alliance between the very, 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 very wealthy and I guess you could say people who still harbor the kind of old-fashioned racial attitudes. And that is that there's such a level of distrust between the races, at least from that end, looking toward the rest of us, that they would actually prefer that the unions be dissolved, not necessarily because it makes their life better or any worse, but because they see the unions as being on the side of those people. People of color, being on the side of the Democratic Party, which is now the party associated with people of color. And the same thing with the voting restrictions, that they're so distrustful of their fellow Americans, the growing population that's more urban and more ethnic and more liberal and more tolerant. They're so distrustful of the America we're becoming that they would actually prefer another form of government than a democracy if it allows basically their side to stay in power. And that's why these voting restrictions are actually being celebrated, because they know that they're being used to prevent those people from voting and diminishing the kinds of political power and political coalitions that they can build. And so I was just wondering if you could help, you know, that you told us at lunch today about this theory that you have, and you've written a paper that's going to be published soon. I was hoping that you could give us a summary of that paper about the shrunken heart syndrome.
Well, I could try to give you a thumbnail sketch of my theory of the shrunken heart or the shriveled heart syndrome. And that is that evolution works in people's philosophies and spirits the same way that it works in the physical body. And the fact that slavery was the moral compromise that our country was even founded on, that it would be racial slavery, not just whoever happened to be enslaved, but it would only be hereditary with the offspring of black women. That was a moral compromise, and slavery is an act of war. It's only enforced by violence. You can't take another human being and take their liberty away from them without it being an act of war and having constant violence or threat of violence against them. So generations of Americans were raised not to have sympathy for people who were being obviously mistreated. So they had to stifle their own innate feelings of sympathy and empathy with other human beings. Human beings, like other animals, have sympathy for people of their own kind who are being hurt or injured. Their natural inclination is to help them. But we had to inbreed in ourselves a coldness and a hardness and not to have sympathy and empathy with people. So after the Civil War, when slavery was reinstated under convict labor, sharecropping, and other ways, Jim Crow, other generations, especially of Southerners, had to suspend or stifle their own feelings of sympathy for mistreated people. So my theory is that after all these centuries and generations of stifling human sympathy and empathy, we have shriveled our own hearts. We have shrunken hearts. And so we don't have a lot of empathy or sympathy for people who are poor, who are sick, who are old, who are outcasts, who are mentally deranged, all of those things. So you can have people of the 1% who already have untold power and wealth, and they have no sympathy whatsoever for anyone because they have suffered from the shrunken heart or the shriveled heart syndrome. And that's very clear in a lot of these communities where we're working, where it's the very wealthy people, the very powerful people, think nothing of taking away health care from people, from poor people, ending unemployment, taking away earned tax credits for working people, all of those things. And this is against a vast majority of people who have supported them in the past. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're talking about in the movement, that we have to understand where this shrunken heart or shriveled heart syndrome comes from, and we have to interdict it at some point and say, maybe the older people, maybe the ones that are super rich or the 1%, maybe we're not going to be able to change them, but at least we can get together and develop enough unity and enough power so that we can overcome their money and their power. And that's what Mr. Boner said here in Bellhaven, that when the people got together and had unity, they developed a power that overcame the power of the money.
Now, Bob is referring to Butch Bonner. He is an elderly, not too old, he's an African-American man in his 60s. He's a member of the White Plains Church, where Annabelle and I filmed recently. And he, when Mayor O'Neill, when Adam O'Neill, who, if you've seen our videos, he's really at the center of the battle to save the hospital. 10 years ago, when Adam decided to run for mayor of this town, he knew that he was going to have to reach out to the African-American community. They're actually the majority of voters here. But the Democratic mayor, who had been in office for 40 years, had basically run the town in such a way that African-Americans had thought it doesn't matter, and they had pretty much stopped voting. And so this Democratic mayor, kind of, I guess you could say more in the mold of the old Dixiecrats, some would argue that, had been in power for a long time. It seemed like he would never, let go. And Mayor O'Neill reached out to the African-American community as a Republican, went into their churches at the urging of this man, Butch Bonner, who is kind of like a mentor to this conservative, this white Southern conservative mayor, who has, you know, really formed over the last 10 years some strong community alliances with the black churches, with families. You know, he's been inside of homes where people can't afford to air condition when it's 100 degrees, or people can't afford to eat anything but crackers. And the mayor was, fighting against interest. I guess you'd call 1% interest in this town before, when he wanted to clean up this old cemetery that they found where African Americans had been buried for a couple of centuries, and it wasn't being kept up. You know, horrible things happening there with, the bodies being exposed to the sun and stuff like that, or the remains. And he used city money to clean that up. And so that coalition that, you see the curious headline, Republican conservative working with NAACP to save a hospital, it wasn't something that was just out of necessity that just formulated suddenly. But actually, this particular man, Adam O'Neill, had formed those coalitions long before it was necessary to pull off this incredible miracle. And I think that's one of the things that Bob's really enjoyed discovering in the day or two that he's been here. Is that right, Bob?
Yes, it's been great, because this is the kind of thing I've been doing for 50 years, and as a white Southerner, I recognize other white Southerners who, when they make the decision to go straight and become a good person, they are really good people.
Yeah, you were saying that there's a cost, right? That, you talked about, your father left the Ku Klux Klan and became a freedom fighter, and his brothers never spoke to him again, right? And you said from that cost, more commitment develops.
Yes. My father broke with his own father. When my father left the Ku Klux Klan, his father, my grandfather, disowned him and took him out of the will. And his brothers, his blood brothers that he grew up with in the same family, same mother, same father, they never spoke to him again in his whole life. one of his sisters was very active in the Ku Klux Klan auxiliary. And they completely, he was dead to them. And so when he, you know, my father went to Bob Jones University, Bob Jones College, which became Bob Jones University. And when he switched from being a Klansman to being a minister of the social gospel and a United Methodist minister, my mother was a school teacher as well, he became a minister of the social gospel and worked with Joe Lowery and Dr. King in Alabama to integrate the buses, to work on school segregation, desegregation, and so forth. So when my father and other people like him broke with the Klan and joined the movement, they had made a huge commitment and taken a huge risk, and therefore they had a lot invested in it, and they became really strong people for the cause. So they weren't, my dad didn't switch from being a Klansman to being the middle of the roader. He switched from being a Klansman to be an active civil rights worker.
And that's what you devoted your life to as well. I think that's a big lesson. I mean, that's a big lesson for me, is that, you know, those Americans who have had the courage to stand up to political violence or to stand up to people who have enormous amounts of wealth to put toward influencing our electoral process. I mentioned the Citizens United decision. Now we've had another one in the last few weeks, the McCutcheon decision, that are basically opening up the floodgates for political spending to influence the outcome of elections. And it's at the same time where we're seeing all of these really sophisticated election law changes to try to limit the influence that people have on those elections. North Carolina is now one of three states who have implemented a slate of laws that are designed to create long lines at the polls in urban centers. Ohio and Wisconsin have followed suit, shortening early voting, complicating the election process so that the long lines appear in the urban centers. Florida, by the way, did that in 2012. They adopted the same recommended laws from the Heritage Foundation and from ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council. Basically, Bob, the 1%, right? They're recommending to lawmakers how you can make it harder for people to influence elections and at the same time making it easier for money to influence elections.
Yeah, that's an example of wanting to take it back to the old days, because in the beginning, the voters in the United States were male, they were white, and they were wealthy, and they were landowners. So if you follow the Koch brothers and Alex and Governor McCrory here in North Carolina and Tillis and Berger, their desires would take you right back to that time when you'd have to be white, male, wealthy, powerful landowners, and then you could vote. Those are the people whose vote counts. Now, the only way that they can make that happen is that they restrict the vote of working people, poor people, immigrants, Latinos, LGBTs, women, all of those things. You restrict those votes because people might want to vote against your narrow program. But if you can restrict the vote, then you might be able to carry it off.
And why do you think, you know, Jeanine asked an interesting question. We just have a few minutes left with Bob Zellner. I see all the callers on there. Hit one if you wanted to get a question in. We're going to close out at the top of the hour at 7 minutes. But I'm going to give you my theory as to why now. You know, why are things flying in the other direction so hard with so much money behind it right now? And here it is. In 2000, we did a census, as we do every 10 years. And when the results were revealed a year later, it showed that our country was becoming a majority-minority country, that the destiny of our country was that it was going to be ruled by coalition. And there was no more of this 1% essentially creating the symbiosis with the master race, with the race that has the majority, and creating a sense that there's some sort of danger from African Americans gaining the right to vote as they did after the Civil War for a brief period until there was a wave of terrorism and violence to end that, especially in the South. That alliance is not going to undermine our right to self-governance in the same way as it had. And so it was during the period of the Bush administration's Justice Department, during that period following the census report, they initiated this massive and expensive taxpayer-funded search for voter fraud in order to justify what was coming later, which is voting restrictions. And the wave of voting restrictions that we see now, the groundwork was laid when actually the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department was turned into a witch hunt for voter fraud. And by the way, in 5 years, they found basically a dozen cases where somebody had voted for a relative to come to the polls out of, you know, 27 million votes that were cast or something like that. So anyway, my theory is that in response to demographic changes, and this has happened in other times in our history, for instance, after emancipation, in response to demographic changes that are going to change the electoral calculus, then things like Citizens United or things like Jim Crow, poll taxes or creating long lines at the polls, which many people equate to poll taxes, that's the countermeasure to what would inevitably happen if we actually did have a system of self-governance where people work together across race and across all other divisions. What do you think of that theory?
Well, I think that your theory is sound. I think that that's what they're trying to do, and I'm confident they're not going to get away with it. But you know, it took 25 or 30 years to put this thing in place, and a lot of it was on the tax structure, because even during Reagan and Clinton, the rate for taxes, we had a progressive tax structure and an income tax, so that it was impossible for CEOs or business owners and so forth to become billionaires. They could become multimillionaires, but to become billionaires and for individuals to own as much as countries do, that's a regressive tax structure. And now they don't even want to pay 35%, whereas under Reagan it might be as high as 90% of income taxes would go to taxes in the upper brackets. So we've gotten used to tremendous upward distribution of wealth, and we have to come back from that. And that's a revolutionary situation to try to make that happen in the face of the money and power that they have. But the People United can match and overmatch that power.
Well, and that's why I think I want to put forth one more theory before we close, and that is that if it's the lack of trust that makes people susceptible to the program of the ruling class, so, for instance, white resentment or white fear of the freed slaves or of African Americans post-Civil Rights era, if it's that lack of trust that they now have extended to basically urban dwellers or Democrats or progressives, extended that over unions, they've extended that fear, that lack of trust, over to really the majority of Americans. If it's a lack of trust that causes them to vote against their own economic interests, then isn't there something we can do, because they are our fellow countrymen, our fellow countrywomen, to extend a hand to bridge that gulf of trust and to make it more likely that they would see that we have common interests? What can we do?
Well, I think we could make it absolutely clear, as Reverend Barber has done, that we are not demonizing the opposition, that we try not to call them names. We're not going to be taking up arms against them. We are going to insist, though, that the people who have common interests work together for those common interests. And what's going to happen is that the more and more extreme that tiny minority gets, the more support they're going to lose. But that can be speeded up by the movement going into communities and doing the kind of grassroots organizing and the kind of grassroots education that will bring a recognition on the part of people who are being hurt by these policies that they're not helped by voting for the economic plan of the 1% because they hurt themselves. And that's a hard nut to overcome because we know that because of the shrunken heart theory and the shrunken heart syndrome, that some people who are working class and poor may actually say, I know it's hurting me, but as long as the black man doesn't get anything out of it, I'm willing to be hurt. Now, that's tiny, tiny minorities. There's not much that you can do with them. So we have to work around them. We don't have to demonize them and so forth, but we have to work around them and work with the people who can be worked with. And in many cases, it's strange to say that sometimes that is Klansmen, sometimes that is Tea Party people who have been mobilized. They want to do something about the situation, but they've been bamboozled to working against their own interests. You even have a lot of fundamentalist and conservative churches now that are coming to the environmental movement, and they're saying, we have a responsibility to God's nature to take care of it. And when Duke Power and other people do things that just increase their own wealth and power at the destruction of the environment and people's health, they'll say, we have to oppose that. So McCrory and other people, Governor McCrory, they're losing a tremendous amount of popularity. Their rates are way down. They're going to go lower, and we're going to bring back a more progressive politics.
Our guest has been Bob Zellner. Happy birthday, Bob. Turned 75 last weekend. Is that correct?
April the 5th, I was 75, young,
oh, okay.
Yes.
Hey, and you had a funny line that you said yesterday that the best revenge against people who tried to kill you is a long life.
That's right. The best revenge and the best solution to the problem is to live healthily, live a long time, and work like heck in the movement because the movement in the end is winning. It wins every time, and we're on the brink of another great victory for freedom and democracy. Amen.
Well, all right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Bob. If you'd like to learn more about the Moral Monday movement, there's a speech that Reverend Barber just gave at the historic Riverside Church up in New York City. It's the same church where Martin Luther King gave his first speech where he really came out against the war in Vietnam. And in the speech, And Bob, if you want to comment on this, you can, but I was going to let you go. But in the speech, Reverend Barber is basically, I think, laying a path for the kind of reconciliation and healing and bridging that breach of trust. It lies through morality. And for Reverend Barber, that means the Christian faith. And he spends a lot of time in the speech talking about the actual teachings of Jesus and the morality of blessed are the poor, caring for the least of these. And he doesn't go into the sort of psychological depth that you did earlier on the show, Bob, talking about how it came to be that in spite of those teachings that so many Americans basically accept the doctrine, for instance, against taking care of the earth, or the doctrine against taking care of our fellow brothers and sisters, and replace it with a different kind of ideology that it mainly uses morality as a way to judge people. For instance, you're gay, I hate you. Or, for instance, you want women to have the right to choose, I hate you. And that's about as far as their religion goes into the public sphere. And what Reverend Barber is saying is that we need to find our way back to the original morality that actually is the heart of all religions, and that is caring for one another. And really, he talks about how Jesus, when he first began to make political speeches, you know, when he basically was spying the Roman Empire, it was an era such as our own where wealth was concentrated to the hands of a very, very tiny elite group of rulers. And that's, you know, in the history of humanity, I mean, that has been pretty much the status quo in America is supposed to be the experiment that extends the right to governance and the right to make decisions to all people. And so it may be that, I'll just say one last thing that I've learned from Moral Monday. Vernon Tyson, the 83-year-old, might be 84 now, Methodist preacher who was arrested on May 20th last year at Moral Monday, he said that in 1830, when the churches split, and there were Northern Baptist churches and Southern Baptist churches, because of slavery, the Civil War was inevitable. And if what you said earlier, Bob, about our country's history being essentially playing out a version of Civil War from the very beginning until now, that had to do with race, a lot of it, but also has to do with economic oppression, that if there's some sort of healing that could take place, and I'm not trying to be a Christian proselytizer or anything, but if there could be a moral focus on public policy, I think that's what Barbara is getting at. And he does extend hands across religious faith and to people who are not religious. If we could apply a moral sense of the common good to public policy, that it might be strong, that unity that would result might be strong enough to overcome a Citizens United decision or the flood of money into the political process or the voting restrictions that we're seeing, basically all of these countermeasures that are designed to prevent that.
Yes, well, he knows that we can overcome that because there's less more of us. There's the 99% of us and there's 1% of them. It's a simplification, of course, but there's a lot more of us than there is of them. And the genius of Reverend Barber is that he unites all people, all religions. And you said the key thing that taking care of the poor and the people who need help is the core of all religions. And he's very clear with the morality of even atheists and agnostics that are in the movement, that it's a moral, we all have a moral compass, no matter what our particular religiosity might be. And he pulls all those people together. And he does it in a humble way. He even though he is slighted by the national leadership, he's slighted by the national press, he makes no issue of that. He's humble. He just keeps on doing the work. And he knows that the work will come to the fore. And it's developing a power that's going to be greater than any one person. And we've learned from Ms. Ella Baker that we all need to be strong leaders. We don't need one charismatic leader that can be picked off and end the whole movement. So he's very clear to be developing leadership all down through the ranks. And that's going to make a tremendous difference in the next quarter of a century in our country.
Okay. Thank you, Bob Zolnitz, for going overtime with us. And thank you to all of our listeners, Janine, Jack from Kansas, thank you for calling in and reminding us that not everything that we're talking about here in terms of battling white supremacy and the Ku Klux Klan is ancient history. There's some recent history that we should address as well. You're listening to Lunch with Loudon on Coffee Party Radio. This is Eric Beiler guest hosting for Janine and Debbie Lynn Molina, who are working hard on Coffee Party's next big move, which you'll be hearing about soon. You can learn more about us at coffeepartyusa.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next show. The next show is Saturday, 1 o'clock, Egberto Willis, Politics Been Right. Until then, signing off. Thanks so much.
Coffee Party on.